The following is a special program of Illinois Public Media. It contains graphic content, including stories of combat, death, and displacement. Some listeners may find the material disturbing.
I remember my parents having a party for me when I got back to Waukegan. There were a lot of people there. And it was really nice to see people. But I didn't feel like I belonged there. I remember going back to our house after our party, and then I asked to borrow my parents' car, and I went down and I spent the night on the beach. I really missed the guys I had been with a lot. To this day, I don't know why I'm here and why it's not somebody else.
You're listening to Still Here, Vietnam War Stories from Illinois, presented by WILL, Illinois Public Media. For the next hour, you're going to hear stories told by people who fought, opposed, and served during the American War in Vietnam, as well as those who became war refugees. Their stories reveal the harshest realities of war and what it meant to survive.
Most of the stories you're about to hear took place between 1967 and 1973.
But events are not presented in chronological order. Some have been simplified or condensed through editing.
Many of our survivors live in or grew up in central Illinois. We are your friends and neighbors.
Still Here is a collection of individual experiences of a violent, traumatic conflict.
A conflict that killed 58,000 American military service personnel.
At least 250,000 South Vietnamese troops.
More than 1 million North Vietnamese soldiers and Viet Cong guerrillas.
And 2 million Vietnamese civilians.
This is a conflict that is still playing out, mostly in secret, in the lives of people in our community.
Carson Peary Scott.
But now, this time, it's just something that I don't understand.
Increasingly cloudy and cold this afternoon, with brief periods of snow flurries, high 18 to 23.
I was born on an army base. My father was a career soldier. When we would go someplace on the bases and we'd have to stop and let soldiers march by, I'd always watch these guys all in step. All of my life, that's what I wanted to be, was a soldier. When I went trick-or-treating, I was always dressed up as a soldier. Kids played cowboy and Indians. I played Army.
The recruiters came to our campus. The Army was recruiting nursing students. What the Army would do was they would pay all of your tuition, books, and all of your fees. And then you get a salary. So my daddy was giving me $10 a month as an allowance. And that was to buy your necessities and to replenish your school supplies and stuff like that. So when they told me it was going to be a $300 check, it was pretty good. And that turned my daddy on too.
This is the main station recruiting center at West Van Buren and Canal Streets in Chicago. The pictures were made in late November. These are young Americans being lifted from all they have ever known to take part in something they have never known. To their parents, they look as impossibly young.
I was born in Northport, Alabama, but I grew up in Chicago, the South Side. In the first month of this year, January 19th, I'm an only child. My mother, she didn't take no mess, and she still don't. I broke her heart when I joined the Marines. She didn't like that at all. you know, because it was a war going on. We had known a bunch of people that they either came back from Vietnam, something was wrong with them, or a lot of them didn't come back. Everybody during that era knew somebody that died over there. Me being 18, I didn't think of death and stuff like that. I didn't see myself going nowhere dying. But my mother, being a more mature person, you know, she understood that. Yeah, and she was really pissed about that.
For the first time since World War II, a lottery draft system. Simply stated, most young men with the highest and lowest numbers knew their future.
And the famous first pick tonight is September 14th, the first birthday that now is designated 001, which means for 19-year-olds born on September 14th, that beginning in January, local draft boards will induct those men born on September 14th, barring deferments.
April 24th.
April 24 is 002.
December 30th.
I'm from Waukegan, Illinois. Waukegan was a real industrial town, very conservative. A lot of guys joined the Army, Air Force, Marines. It wasn't unusual. Before Vietnam, I was a pretty average student. I had no intention of going to college. Because of that intention, I was drafted. I didn't really have any strong feelings one way or the other whether I should go or I shouldn't go. There was some controversy, but not a lot, especially amongst the students. We didn't really talk about it very much.
My parents had no money. There were a lot of kids at home, and my father was always struggling financially, and as often as not, whatever I made on summer jobs, I would just give to the family. So I borrowed money to go through school. I went to Notre Dame.
NBC News presents another in a series of special reports on the Vietnam War. Here is NBC
I was,
News
as far as I knew, a supporter of the war, having never really thought beyond what was in the mainstream newspapers and the mainstream television coverage.
Losses for the week, U.S. losses from hostile action were 11. One KIA, one MIA, and 9 wounded in action.
Every night, you had the nightly body count.
Last week, these were 31, as you recall. 4 killed in action and 27 wounded in action.
The estimated number of Vietnamese killed was always 5 or 10 times higher than the estimated number of Americans. It struck me that the death toll was wildly uneven between the two sides.
We will prevail in Vietnam over the communist aggressor.
I was born in Da Lat, Vietnam. Da Lat usually in my head because it's a very beautiful city. Lakes, hills, all the pine tree, all the flowers year round. I used to went with my mom in the morning to all the farms 3 miles away from the center of the city. My mom bought all the strawberries from the farm and we carry them back to the market to sell to the retailers. Yeah, I have 2 brothers and 6 sisters. I have a big family, a very close family, a loving family, you know.
The place is Dien Bien Phu in French Indochina. The year is 1954. The lonely jungle outpost, surrounded by communist guerrillas and accessible only by air, is doomed.
I was born in 1946 in Quang Binh province of North Vietnam. 1954, my country had to divide 2 parts.
At Geneva, half a world away, Vietnam is carved in two as the weary and discouraged French hand over the northern part to the communists.
Up north belonged to the communists. My family, we rich, and communists They dislike people have property or money. If we don't flee the communist, they will kill my parents and my family. I have to flee North Vietnam. My country needs me to defend our freedom against the NVA, Viet Cong. So I joined the army. My government chose me to have a training in the U.S. And I came here for U.S. Marine Corps training and back to Vietnam and fight again, communists.
In the years since U.S. jets began hitting targets in communist North Vietnam, there has been much disagreement about what the U.S. is doing, should be doing, or how it's doing.
Students and faculty members on the Urbana campus were among those who participated in a nationwide series of discussions on our most serious foreign policy problem. Sponsored locally by the Ad Hoc Faculty Committee on Vietnam.
I enlisted. Out of all the guys that were in service, I was probably that 2% that walked in and said, I'll go. I was only 18, and I enlisted because the truth of the matter was my heart was broken. My girlfriend had broken up with me. If I could have gone into French Foreign Legion, I probably would have done that instead. I got on the train early in the morning, took the train from Rantoul to Champaign, got off. The recruiter's office was right across the street from where Christie Clinic is, but at the time there was a barber college there. A friend of mine was actually going to school at the barber college. I went to the barber college and told him to take my hair off, and he asked me why, and I told him I was going to walk across the street and join the army. And he thought I was crazy. I walked across the street and had to walk through protesters from the U of I who were protesting the war of Vietnam. And I walked into the recruiter's office and I told him I wanted to join the Army. I wanted to volunteer for Vietnam and I wanted to ship out today. And he said, well, first of all, you cannot volunteer for Vietnam until you are trained. He said, and the second thing is it'd be impossible to ship you out today because you got to take a bunch of tests. And I said, if I don't ship out today, I'm going back home and I'm going to call it off. And he and another recruiter got together and started whispering things, and they spent all day with me taking these tests, and that afternoon I was on the train going to Chicago for my induction. So I got what I wanted.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me the oath of enlistment. I
Robert E.
do solemnly swear or affirm.
Do solemnly swear.
During your whole training cycle, they pushed you to the brink. Drill instructors during that era could put their hands on you. You know, they would beat your butt, period. And they would call you the N-word and anything else they wanted to call you. It was kind of like an accepted thing. They brainwashed you.
Whatever you're told to do something, do it good.
They had a command where they would say, at ease. When they say at ease, we would say kill. And then when we finally sit, we would say Viet Cong. They had the huts and stuff set up. It looked just like Vietnam. And we would go there over and over and over again. We would assault that village. Never thinking that it's possibly women, children, and all that in this village. By the time you got to Vietnam, you were ready to shoot anything look Vietnamese.
At Notre Dame, there were people who would tell you, you know, somebody would come home for the summer from college and someone would say, what are you majoring in? And, well, right now I'm majoring in avoiding the draft. There were student deferments. You had to fill out an application for one every year, but as long as you were in school and a student in good standing, then you were deferred from the draft for the duration. The professor I had for certainly the most difficult course I had as a freshman, it was a course in symbolic logic. He himself was a graduate student at Indiana U, which had a branch in South Bend. He was heavily involved in the local anti-war movements and what small groups there were at that point. It was easy for me to dismiss him because, you know, he had long hair and he was in a folk group and he wrote songs and some of them were protest songs and yeah, you know, a bunch of hippies.
This is a different kind of war. There are no marching armies or solemn declarations.
This professor of mine had been part of this movement against Johnson and against the war. And
we did not choose to be the guardians at the gate, but there is no one else.
I said I thought Johnson had done a pretty good job. So after class, we were talking, and he invited me to just come to his apartment and drink some Cokes and talk. By the time that conversation was over, he had planted the seeds of a realization that raising questions and honestly looking for answers rather than just accepting a line and taking what you read in the mainstream press as always true might actually be a good idea.
When you first land there, you land in a real safe area, just like being in Champaign-Urbana. I landed in a place called Cameron Bay, which was a huge Navy and Air Force facility. Beautiful, huge bay, just full of crystal clear water. You stay there when you come in country till you get assigned a unit. I took a helicopter up to the northern part of the country. I was the new guy. They were called FNGs. I won't tell you what the F stands for, but the N stands for new, and the G is guy. You could probably figure out the rest.
During my service in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, I was an area door gunner. One of our first missions where I went, and we actually was engaged in combat, where I was afraid to shoot the weapon. I was stuck. I know we was being shot at, but I just could not pull the trigger. And holes started appearing in the helicopter everywhere. You know, the other guys on the helicopter, yeah, they was pretty pissed. They said, if you can't do this, then you can't do this.
A combat medic is a little bit like a first responder. You administer first aid to them, and then you get them ready for transportation back into a real hospital with the medical personnel that know what they're doing. When I first got to Vietnam, I hadn't even taken anybody's temperature yet. I was an inexperienced combat medic, and I had to put 2 weeks in at a place called the Battalion Aid Station. Battalion aid station is a like a MASH. Civilians come in. A lot of the civilians were children. And I remember a lot of kids with their legs blown off. One little girl, her sister brought her in. And I distinctly remember this girl, she had it looked like a shark bite out of her leg. She was laying there, and this girl wasn't crying or whimpering or anything. She was a real trooper. I'd have been screaming my ass off. And the POWs, you know, they came in, and I distinctly remember one POW. He was an older POW. He was laying motionless, more or less, on this stretcher, and he had something in his eye. He was going like this, constantly going like this, and so I got a wet sponge or rag or something, and I kind of wiped his eye out. He spit on me, and I thought, well, you son of a bitch. And I got a handful of sand out the front door, and I went back and put it in his eyes. I thought, you know what? They don't care for us. I am kind of ashamed of that, but he pissed me off.
I was at the 24th Evacuation Hospital. It was not a fixed building. It was called Quonset Hut, which is a metal that's a half circle on concrete. The beds were regular army cots. I had about 20 of them on the floor where I worked. Most of the people had either had some kind of combat wound, broken legs or missing limbs or abdominal wounds with the bowels on the outside. Would occasionally have some that were paralyzed. I had one that was on a circle bed. He was paralyzed from neck down, couldn't move himself. And he told me he didn't want no black nurse taking care of him. And I told him, look, you are not dying on my watch. He was still groaning while I had him face down And I says, I don't care what you say, you are not dying on me. I was 22, and some of them may have been older or whatever, but they looked at me like I was their mother, and some of them actually clung to me as if I was their mother. And I just say that was only by the grace of God, because I tell you, I had no experience to be as mature as they forced me to be.
One of the first people that I met when I got to Vietnam, first civilians, was in the village of Chu Lai. She was a laundry girl. She was a little girl whose parents did laundry, and that's how they made their money. Her folks were so nice, she asked me to come to dinner at their house. And so I was the guest of honor, and it was really strange. There must have been 10 people in here. I was, and I didn't understand a single word that was being spoken except Kim, which was her name, and her dad wanted to talk to me. His real intention was he wanted me to take his daughter to the United States. He said, you know, if you can take her, then we can all come over there. I had no intentions of taking a Vietnamese girl to the United States. I don't know what happened to Kim and her family after I left.
The first time I heard the gunshot, I was in my class, and then the teacher told us that you guys have to go home now because they are fighting on the street. It was so scary. They burned many houses there to kill Viet Cong. We had to stay inside all the time, and we just looked through the window to see what was going on the street. I heard many screaming, and then I saw some helicopters flying on the sky, and they shoot rockets and machine guns. My mom said that we cannot live here. We need to move to the center of the city.
You've got it on the side. You can't carry it.
When we go down into a LZ, which is a landing zone, we actually only supposed to be on the ground seconds, not minutes, seconds. We had went down this LZ and we was extracting troops. And this one particular guy, how it happened, I don't know, but the Viet Cong, they were chasing him. And he was running and he would get in this real dense places like with trees and shrubbery and all that stuff, and you wouldn't see it, but you seen all these Viet Cong, and you said, oh man, they done got him. And then you look down there again, lo and behold, there he is again, running another way. We was up there cheering for him. This guy was just something else. He made up his mind, I'm not dying today. And we went and got him.
We were operating very close to another unit of our company, and it was getting near dusk. There was a loud explosion. We got on the radio and raised these guys on the radio and asked them what had happened, and this is what they told us. They said a turkey, if you can believe this or not, a turkey had wandered into their mechanical ambush and set off a Claymore mine. And I never saw a turkey in Vietnam, but that's what they said. We thought, well, that's pretty good. We're going to all have turkey instead of, you know, sea rations. And they said, no, you stay where you're at. So we kind of grumbled about it a little bit. Half an hour or so later, another explosion went off. And we thought, great, another turkey. And we tried to raise them on the radio. We couldn't raise them. What happened to them was a 105 round had been booby-trapped by the enemy. And when it blew, it killed 7 guys outright. And then the rest of the guys in the platoon were wounded to the point they had to ship them home. And we lost 8 guys in one day. And I didn't understand what this was all about, but they took us out of the field and we had a memorial service back in the rear for these guys. And there was a chaplain. It wasn't inside a building. It was outside. It was on some wooden benches that were sitting on top of some telephone pole studs. It was our benches. When they started to mention these guys' names, They called them by their Christian names, their birth names, and I didn't really know who they were talking about. Most of us only had nicknames, and that's how we knew each other by. You know, there was a guy named Spider, there was a guy named Fast Eddie, and later I found out his name was Edward Furman. The names were alien to me. I couldn't put faces to these names. I've never depended on somebody like I did these guys. There's been several times that they had my back. I got excited because they were screaming, "Medic, medic, medic." You live with them 24/7, and there's some that you like better than the others, but you love them all. And I regarded them as my family, and whenever we were attacked or ambushed or threatened, I took it really very personal that they were trying to hurt somebody in my family. My friendship to these guys is so strong, I wouldn't change a thing.
It was weird. I think the most concentration of females was at the hospitals. I was 22 and they were 18 to 25. I would get requests from some people because they heard that there was this easygoing lady over there. I don't know, but they came to me and I thought, got the wrong person. The photographer there had taken my picture. And I was hearing people saying, so-and-so has your picture and says that you're his girlfriend. And I'm thinking, what is this? The photographer was actually selling my pictures.
I'll never forget that first patrol that I had. There was what I pictured as that Vietnam would be like. It was rice paddies. It was little villages, lots of palm trees. It was really pretty, but I was so scared. You have a safety on your weapon, and I remember I had my thumb on that safety and my finger on the trigger, and I figured I was going to be quick enough to pull that safety off and fire that weapon if I had to. We had been out on patrol, and we had been receiving on and off fire from different places. We were with our platoon, which is about 30 people. And our squad, which consisted of about 8 to 10 people, we somehow got separated from the rest of our platoon. And we started receiving a lot of heavy fire. All of a sudden, all these rounds of artillery started coming in on top of us. My squad leader, Frank, thought that, you know, we had run into a huge group of NVA soldiers. And that's what I thought at the time, too. Come to find out later on that part of our platoon was up higher than we were. And when we started receiving a few mortar rounds from the Viet Cong, part of our platoon thought that these mortar rounds were coming from where we were. And so they started shooting at us. And, of course, we returned the fire. And then our lieutenant called in artillery. It came in on top of us. There were two casualties that day. One of them was a sergeant by the last name of Cumbie. I remember getting on the helicopter and Frank and I were next to each other. Frank had gotten hit where his arm was pretty much just kind of hanging there. I had a big bunch of shrapnel in my shoulder, and Sergeant Cumbie was in the body bag that was in front of us. Cumbie lost his life. He had only been out in the field for 1 week, I think.
By the middle of junior year, I knew the coursework that I was doing in these philosophy of nonviolence courses was going to form the basis of an application for conscientious objector status. That whole application process came to be largely what I objected to myself. It was wildly inequitable. Yeah, it was partly skin color. It was partly just having been fortunate enough to get enough of an education to be reasonably articulate about what was known in those days as a CO statement. You basically had to write this statement, think of it as a brief, explaining yourself. It was part privilege and part a roll of the dice. The only universally available method of keeping from contributing to what I was increasingly seeing as really an ethically untenable situation was to just refuse to do it. When I went back after senior year, I was a pretty committed non-cooperator, so I did not take out a student deferment my senior year. These letters started coming. The first one was to report for a physical. The next several, they were probably half threat and half reminder. Sometimes I would write snarky things on the envelope and send it back unopened. Sometimes I would open it and then just throw it away. As it happened, every violation of the draft law was a separate felony worth 5 years and $10,000 if you got the max. Failure to appear for the physical was a separate crime all by itself. Failure to carry a draft card, which I had long since ceased to do. Actually, junior year, I didn't burn it, but I did tear it up in front of a crowd of people on the steps of the administration building at Notre Dame. Not too dramatic. Not having the card was theoretically a separate offense. I contemplated leaving. I had people offering to drive me up to Montreal and decided not to. I still felt, despite everything that was going on, that the country was worth staying in and working towards improving. I was more optimistic then than I've ended up being. I considered myself law-abiding, had never even had a parking ticket at that point, but I think it was Thoreau that said, when the laws are unjust, the only place for the just man is in prison. You know, that's pretty dramatic, but I was 21.
You know? 1968 A.D., a year in the life of man.
The Viet Cong call for a ceasefire during Tet, the Buddhist New Year period. But Tet is no holiday.
The Tet Mo Tan. Very, very big fight.
While Washington wondered, the Viet Cong struck at Saigon, Hue, and almost every other city.
The communist betray us. I happened to fight very hard. And that time I was wounded twice. And I was wounded in my eyes. They bring me to the hospital. And the doctor said, oh, you are very lucky. If the Viet Cong wounded, I also take care of them the same I take care of my soldier. I'm ready to rescue, to medevac them to hospital. When they are wounded, they are not my enemy.
The enemy, very deceitfully, has taken advantage of the Tet Truce.
For us, it turned out to be just horrific.
In order to create maximum consternation.
They were in every little city and village in South Vietnam. And a lot of them were like suicide bombers. I mean, they just came at you and they wouldn't stop until you killed them. Right after the Tet Offensive, we got a whole new group of people. Those are the guys that I can't remember. I've tried, and I can't remember faces or names, and I was with these guys for 5 months, and I don't know why I can't remember them. When I joined Charlie Company after that, the guys that survived it were really mean and really nasty. And we would go into certain villages and they would just start beating people up, especially older folks. And that's disgusting. I got into my very first fist fight as an Army soldier because of that. And he was so messed up in the head, he shouldn't have been out in the field anymore. And he started beating up this old guy, trying to get information out of him. And the old guy was so old, he didn't know anything. And that's when he and I got into it. That just does things to your mind. I don't know. I never wanted to harm children, and especially, I've actually never harmed anybody as far as civilians. The only people that I took my frustrations out on were what I viewed as the enemy.
How are you, G.I. Joe? It seems to me that most of you are poorly informed about the going of the war, to say nothing about a correct explanation of your presence over here. Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die or to be maimed for life without the faintest idea of what's going on.
The Viet Cong was slick. You had to think we were so isolated over there in Vietnam. The stuff that was going on in the United States, we didn't know nothing about it. Most of the time, the Viet Cong would let us know. They would just speak over loudspeaker about what was going on. And they would say stuff like, "Black man, it's not your war. Why don't you go home? Don't you know in Detroit this is going on? Or in Chicago this going on?"
This is the day after Martin Luther King died, and the American Negro community is clearly angry, often uncontrollably angry, over his murder.
Here they come. They're charging into
it. Let's see. It was the morning that we heard that Martin Luther King had been killed. The cafeteria was extremely tense that morning, and one of the people who I had become, thought we could have been pretty good friends, his comment was, "All we got to do now is to get rid of Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael." And I just picked up a meal tray and I hit him across the head with it. Well, they were about to get me, and he came to my rescue and said, no. I know this girl too well. Should have kept my mouth shut."
We came out of the field and we were assigned these bunkers to guard. Usually three or four guys per bunker. These guys were partying hardy. They were rolling their joints and having a good time. And I was the only one looking out the window expecting the human wave attack to come any minute. And I thought, these guys aren't doing their job. And, you know, they're sloughing off. And who am I to tell these guys what to do? They've been here for months. I've only been here for a few weeks. And they told me that before I left, I would be just like them. And they were right.
I learned how to suppress, though. A lot of guys I was in Vietnam with, I couldn't tell you their name. I do not know their names. We stayed drunk and high all the time. That was an accepted thing. They had some pills over there, basically speed. So I wouldn't get drowsy, I wouldn't be sleepy, and I would feel like I'm still alert. And then, after I get back to the rear and it's time for me to go to sleep or whatever, I take something, it'd either be heroin or I would try to drink it down. We used to go get a prostitute and bring her inside the base at night and have her inside the bunker with us all night. Most of the time, you end up with gonorrhea. It was par for the course. That was part of it. You almost knew. Because you got to think, they didn't have condoms in Vietnam.
Okay, you give me money.
They were local women, Vietnamese. They were quite young, but you didn't know that at the time. Because from the age probably of 15 to 25 or something like that, you can hardly tell the difference.
I discovered that I had been indicted on the federal charges when my mother read it in the Richmond newspaper and called to let me know. And I said, well, you know, we knew this was coming. There was a time in my life when every time I did anything that was remotely important, there would be a thunderstorm. I don't know what explained this, but there was a thunderstorm the day of the trial that just blackened the skies and shook the chandeliers in the courtroom. The judge, truth to tell, there was probably little he could do except find me guilty, so he did. And my 4 years out of a possible five was the lightest he had ever given. Everybody else who had ever come before him for that had gotten 4.5. I knew what was coming, up to a point. I didn't really have an accurate picture of prison life, that's for sure. There was the constant threat of violence, and you constantly had to be aware. It was my introduction to an aspect of existence that women live with all the time, but most guys don't have occasion to experience. But when you are in a situation like that, and as I've told people for years, you're young, small, white, and stupid, it didn't help. Pacifism, to me, is a recognition that there is almost never an excuse for violence. Pacifism doesn't mean shying away from anything. It certainly doesn't mean appeasement. It does mean facing down what you might legitimately see as evil. And yes, that means taking gigantic chances sometimes. It could very well mean dying when you come right down to it. That's heavy-duty stuff, and, you know, I don't know that under all circumstances I would be brave enough to follow through on it. The one serious test that I had of it, I did manage to get through.
Tell us about that.
Well, when you come right down to it, this is where the story ceases to be romantic and, you know, gets really down and dirty. But it was a rape attempt in the Richmond City Jail. Jailhouse and prison rape is an entirely different phenomenon than what it is in other contexts. It has nothing to do with any kind of sexual orientation or sexual deprivation or anything like that. It's sheer dominance. The phrase is taking your manhood. It was heavy duty. The guy just beat the hell out of me when you come right down to it. There was no knowing at the beginning of it whether I would survive it or not. He was big enough that he could have killed me if he set his mind to it. I just stood there and stared him in the face and kept saying no. And he kept pounding on me. And, you know, I don't know why he stopped, finally. I just don't know. Maybe the man was coming. I have no idea. I never saw him again. I was put in what is politely called protective custody. The real translation of that is solitary.
When you first go there, you know that this is from this date to that date. And when you start getting close to that date, it's when fear really come in. Because a lot of guys then got killed and had a week, had 3 days left. What I remember more than the flight is when we landed in San Francisco and all these demonstrators was calling us baby killers and all that kind of stuff. You know, and how the military basically was telling us, don't wear your uniform. There was a lot of demonstrators and stuff that was trying to harm us. When I left the United States, I was a hero before I even went. I could be walking down the street and have my uniform on, and a cab would just stop and say, hey, Marine, where you going? Come on, get in. And wouldn't charge me anything. I came back, and it was a whole different ball game a year and a month later. Everything changed.
I stopped at the gas station to buy back cigarettes. There was a woman behind this counter that she was just an older woman, looked like she could make an apple pie and get a blue ribbon. And she said, did you just get back from vacation in Florida? And I said, no, I just got back from Vietnam, and her whole attitude changed towards me. Her exact words were a big f***ing deal.
Well, one of my patients had written to me, and he wanted to meet me at the Air Force Base when we came back in, and he was going to take me out to lunch. He came with his parents, and his parents didn't say anything to me, but he says, my parents won't take you out to lunch because you're black. And I said, well, did you tell your parents why you wanted to take me out to lunch? And he says, yeah, but I gotta live with them.
I have asked for this radio and television time tonight for the purpose of announcing that we today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
A North Vietnamese tank broke the gate of the president's palace in Saigon. A communist soldier ran the revolution's flag across the empty lawn. The shooting on this day the communists won was not in a battle, but a celebration.
April 29, 1975. When that time I commanded 800 South Vietnam Marine, I got the order from my general. Delay the approaching of North Vietnam at least 24 hours. I have to fight very hard. Some of my soldiers, they want to run. But they saw me still over there. In that time, we run out everything. We run out everything. And they killed a lot of my soldiers. And after that, we have to surrender. The Viet Cong come to my base. And he said, you want to be killed? I said, no problem. They didn't kill me.
My city started to know that we belong to Viet Cong. There are some undercover Viet Cong. They came from house to house and told us that the soldiers are coming. Went to the street and welcomed them. We didn't want to go, but you know, we were so scared and we had to go to the street, stand by the side of the street and saw all the tanks with all the Viet Cong soldiers sit on top of that and wait to us. And I feel sad and lost. We didn't know where to go. I had a feeling that, okay, now we was left behind.
You know, even though you physically came over here on that plane, your mind and everything is still in Vietnam. I came back an addict, an alcoholic, drinking and drugging. That's how I cope. You be thinking that. It's a whole lot of guys that ain't got legs, arms, can't see anymore and all of that. And here I am, healthy and all of this. And I'm not finna go to the VA and be crying about the fact that I seem to can't get along with nobody. Or I'm having these dreams, these nightmares and stuff that keep waking me up. I even had to tell my wife, say, certain times when you hear me moaning or something in my sleep, touch me, wake me up, because in my mind, I'm living that again. We're not designed to go into combat. You can take an individual and you can train him, you can give him all of this, but when that person starts killing people, regardless if those people trying to kill him or her, you pay for that. You pay for that spiritually, emotionally, and particularly psychologically.
And it was the Danville VA that you then went to?
Yes, I went to the Danville VA. That was the VA where I met and talked with psychiatrists, and that was the VA where I joined Vietnam groups. I joined groups that deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. That was 2013.
Wow, so it's not that long, like 5 years.
No, it wasn't that long at all. That's what I'm saying. I mean, prior to that, you would have seen a totally different person. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't have talked to you. I'm motivated because I realize there's other Vietnam veterans out there that need to go to the VA, because the VA has got professionals there now that can help you.
Since returning from Vietnam, it's caused a lot of health problems for myself, strange fatigue, neurological problems, respiratory distress. I constantly keep colds and flu-like illnesses.
I'd never heard the word Agent Orange until I came back from Vietnam. I didn't even know what it was. My mother called me up and told me there was something on TV about Agent Orange. I had no idea what she was talking about. Later found out that it was a big deal. It was a real big deal.
We were getting calls from men 29, 30 years old with four or five different kinds of cancer all through their body.
Agent Orange is like weed control on steroids. It kills all vegetation. They would line these planes up, come in low and spray the vegetation, and it might take a while for the vegetation to die. It doesn't just... A few years ago, I contracted prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is one of the top three symptoms of Agent Orange poisoning, and I'll probably die from something like that.
I started being proud of my service about 1984, but before that I was more embarrassed by it because I was accused of prolonging the war. I was called a baby killer. One of my daughter's preschool classmate's father said that I had to be a liar when I went to the school to tell him about my Vietnam experience because there were no women in Vietnam. And so we had to settle that up. People were saying, why don't you guys get over this? And I would get mad because they would pretty much blame the victim. We're the ones who just can't get over it, and you guys are all straight.
My 24 months boiled down to somewhere north of 17 months. My then girlfriend, it was she who picked me up at prison the day I got out, and we've been together ever since. Every job application I ever filled out always asked, have you ever been convicted of a felony? I always said yes. If yes, then give details. I gave details. And the details always ended with presidential pardon 1977.
Good evening. On his first full day as president, Jimmy Carter kept
the very first thing that Carter did after taking the oath of office, even before delivering the inaugural address, was to sign a blanket pardon for any draft violator in the whole Vietnam period. So all the guys who had fled to Canada, all the guys who had fled to Sweden, people who had been indicted but had never been caught, full, free, and unconditional pardon.
He gave a complete and unconditional pardon.
Although it was, in my case, it was obviously too late to spare me all the fun.
I feel that I don't have a future. All the decent men, they gone to jail, to the re-education camp. So I decided not to get married.
I released out of prison 1985, December. When I released out of prison, I did about 70 pounds. My belief in God helped me to survive. It helped me to be strong.
When I met my husband now, I was about 32 already.
She's just about 32 years old, and I almost 40.
I worked with a friend, and her husband was my husband's friend.
And my friend, her friend too.
He was in jail about 10 years. I think, okay, he's an educated man. He was the former Vietnam Army, so that's good for me because I don't want to get married to a Viet Cong.
She's still very beautiful.
So I decided to get married with him.
I will love her all my life. And from that time, I feel I'm happy. 1990, I got the permission from U.S. government grant me and my family political asylum here.
My husband has a brother who went overseas by boat in 1985, and he ended up in Urbana, Illinois. Do you believe that when we came to the USA, we had only $900? Public assistance from the government here, that means cash, food stamp, so we survived with that. My husband went back to school to learn his English again, and then I stay home with my kids. He got a job at some factory Yeah, and he stayed there until he retired.
I still got nightmare. Sometimes I got nightmare. Sometimes I dream about the time I was in labor camp. I want to die. But after that, I wake up. I realize I'm in America. I am American now, you know. I am American now.
In 1975, then, I met my wife. And I was having a lot of problems up to that time. As soon as I met her, things really changed. She's really the kindest person I know. Whenever I made mistakes, and boy, I sure made a lot of them, she made everything okay. So this is where I am today. A lot different from when I was 18 years old. I was so young, caught up in a period of history, I didn't know any better. I would say if the same thing happened to me now, there's no way that I would go there. I'm lucky. I'm a very, very lucky person.
Still Here, Vietnam War Stories from Illinois, feature the voices and stories of
Terry Harrell from Waukegan, Illinois,
Donald Jerome Heitch, United States Marine, currently live in Champaign,
Timothy Kendall, draft resister,
Constance Love Edwards, a nurse who served in Vietnam,
Jerome Weesey, a combat medic from Rantoul, Illinois.
My name is born Bui.
And my name is Utha. I am Bon's wife. We have married for about 31 years.
Okay. You got some names here. Kimberly Crank. Still Here was produced by Kimberly Crank and John Facile.
Research by Maggie Servit, Jack Brighton, and Nathan Tai.
Sound design by John Facile. Additional sound mixing by Travis Dunsmuir.
Engagement consultant Elizabeth Simpson. Additional production by Max Green.
Military gear foley by Rich Pooler.
Interviews conducted by Kimberly Cronick.
Cassidy Williams.
Mark DePew.
Wendolin Pepin.
Aaron Dira Franco.
And Jasmine Monaco.
Special thanks to Charles Stretch Ledford and the students in his multimedia reporting class.
Still Here featured the music of Bill McKay, Joshua Abrams, Riley Walker, Travis Dunsmuir, and Rob Mazurek.
The selections of Vietnamese music were from the record label Sublime Frequencies and the Smithsonian's Folkways Recordings.
To learn more about the lives of the people featured in this documentary, as well as other Illinois veterans and civilians, or to listen again, visit wheel.illinois.edu/Vietnam.
Still Here, Vietnam War Stories from Illinois. It's a production of WILL, Illinois Public Media.
Thank you. Okay, excellent.